I'm David Humphrey, and this is Sound and Vision on WPS1 Art Radio. My guest today is New York painter Alexi Wirth, sometimes writer. Welcome, Alexi.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, we are in for a little bit of a treat, a little bit of a change in the format. Usually, artists bring music, and today you've got another idea.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of playlists in mind, and I felt like a lot of them were falling into the kind of punk, funk, country spectrum that everyone else had done so well. And so I thought I would do something that means even more to me than all of those, which is I would bring poems. And these are all poems spoken by the people who wrote them. Some of them are they're old cassettes that I've had for 25 years or more, and so they're a little crackly.
Well, that will indicate somehow some space, some quality of time passing. I think of your paintings in some ways as like poems. They're very compressed, they're very crafted, and narrative in the way that sometimes poems can be.
I love the idea of narrative. I think it's it's tricky to make something where the narrative or the situation, sometimes situation is a better way for me to think about it, but a situation where choices are implicit somehow, where stuff is on the edge of changing, falling forward or backward.
And I guess for a painting, that falling would be falling into a past and into a future. There's kind of a crux between then and what will come.
Right, right.
And I guess in some ways I think of your paintings as having a very oddly displaced quality of voice, that there's always a sort of figuration within them of the position of the artist / spectator that complicates the narrative.
More and more I think of them as being vocative paintings, right, where the viewer is right there being addressed some way. Yeah.
It kind of changes the sense of person, I guess, even of voice, because they're not exactly like songs. They're not saying, I feel, I think, I make, but somehow it's been layered.
Yeah, I think that, songs could have been an analogy for them too, in my mind, but there's, I love the idea of a kind of intimacy with the viewer, of feeling like you're recognized in more than you expect to be by the painting.
I love that about your paintings, and sometimes that intimacy is complicated. There's a tiny barrier. There's something standing in between that makes a resistance and maybe a meaning.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, but for many years I wanted it to be the opposite way. I wanted everything to be, I wanted to display everything to be generous to the viewer. And it's one of those times when the idea that you resist turns out to be the right idea, the thing that you're holding back on, thinking, oh, no, I can't do that. And then you just like try it once and realize, uh-oh, this is what I really want to do.
Well, maybe courtship is more the process rather than generosity.
Yes, big time, exactly right.
I guess no one wants to be given a gift they didn't expect or ask for. I don't know. Maybe there's another way of phrasing that.
But no, that's right. You want to work for something a little bit. Yeah, yeah. That's the best part.
So what are we going to hear?
The first thing is William Carlos Williams, who has a beautiful kind of old woman's, old man's voice, and sets up this poem with just a super short intro that I love.
The visit. This was a visit paid to me by it. You should never explain the poem, but it always helps, nevertheless. This was a very charming lady that came to see me on a very pointed mission. I have committed many errors, but I warn, the interplay is not the tossed body. Though the mind is subtler than the sea, advancing at three speeds, the fast, the medium, and the slow, recapitulating at every ninth wave what was not at first directly stated, that is still only on the one level. There are the fish, and at the bottom, the ground. No matter whether at 5 feet or 5 miles, the ground, revealing when bared by the tides, living barnacles, hungry on the rocks as the mind is, that hiss as often loudly when the sun bites them. And I acknowledge the mind is still, though rarely, more than its play. I can see also the dagger in the left hand when the right strikes. It does not alter the case. Let us resume. The naive may be like a sunny day, deceptive, and is not to be despised because it is so amusing to see the zigzag and slender gulls dip into the featureless surface. It is fish that they are after, fish, and get them. Still, I acknowledge that the sea is there, and I admire its profundity. Only what does it amount to? Love also may be deep, deepest thought, deeper than thought, and as sequential. Thought full of detail, let us say, as the courts are full of law, and the sea weeds, and as murmurous. That does not alter the case either. Yet, you are right, in the end, law often decides cases. Well, I prefer to go back to my cases at the hospital. So I am less an artist than a spade worker. Say I am less an artist than a spade worker, but one who has no aversion to taking his spade to the head of any who would derogate his performance in the craft. You were very kind to be at such pains with me, and thank you for the hue.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's, to me, a fascinating and not that well-known Williams poem. It's essentially a complicated, oblique way of turning down a groupie. And it's full of these incredibly sharp Williams images. And I just love that the way his voice is so fresh and direct to me, it's like a barometer of total authenticity.
He's so sly.
Yeah.
He knows how to displace and it is a kind of a courtship, even if it's a refusal.
Oh, right, for sure. It's more, again, it's like what we were saying. It's kind of the blocked courtship is the best kind. Half of me thinks that this isn't what happened. It's just the poem he wrote.
He doesn't want his interlocutor to go away unsatisfied, even if they're not getting what they want.
Right. I think he might have, the interplay might have been the tossed body, but he wrote it, he wrote it another way.
So what's next?
The next one is Robert Lowell. And this is, again, it's a poem that I think is not so canonical. And in recent people have put together, J.D. McClatchy, for instance, has put out a bunch of really well-selected and edited versions of Lowell and other terrific American poets. But this poem is not on any of them, and I think it's really one of his greatest poems, and I think it's should be better known. And it's also so, to me, so perfect and beautiful, and it's a tribute to another writer. And it begins with a little story about playing golf. And Lowell, again, Lowell sets it up really beautifully, and I think it's great to hear the difference between Lowell's talking voice and the poem, which has a kind of chanting thing that begins to happen. And then it cuts back at the very end, and it kind of goes just very simple.
Now, this poem is an elegy. It's my own, not a translation. It's about the novelist Ford Madox Ford. Some of you know who he is, some of you don't. He was sort of a bridge between the generation of Henry James and Conrad, Stephen Crane, and those people, and the later generation of T.S. Eliot and Lawrence. And he knew these people and published many of them for the first time. And he was, in a few books, I think, a very great novelist himself. And I knew him when I was a boy of 19 or so, and he was at the end of his life, an Englishman traveling through America. He'd spent his money, and he talked to audiences, and he was very inaudible, and it was a great act of courage, I think, to come to these audiences and tell his elaborate anecdotes that couldn't be understood. He was a person who had a large man with a rather contemptuous manner, and contempt and generosity seemed to stand out in his character that nobody discovered more young writers. And at the end of his life, he was still discovering young people such as Eudora Welty. He was a tremendous storyteller, and his stories often improved on life, and they were better than what happened. And the poem starts with one of these that I don't know how some of it's true, and there's no question about his being a hero, but he was playing golf with Asquith and Lloyd George just before the First World War, and he used a niblick in an unorthodox place and hit his ball way up in the air, and it went on the green and fell into the cup. And Lloyd George was furious and said that, I don't care about your getting it in the cup, but it's the awful art. And Ford said, for you to talk to me about art is like a blacksmith giving a midwife advice on handling, bearing children. And Ford said that was why he was never a major general in the First World War. One of his most famous novels, called The Good Soldier, which some critic described as someone said it's the best novel in the language technically, and the other critic said, no, it's the best French novel. Ford Madox Ford, 1873 to 1939. The lobbed ball plops, then dribbles to the cup. A birdie, Fordy, but it nearly killed the ministers. Lloyd George was holding up the flag. He gabbled, hop-toed, hop-toed, hop-toed. Ford has used a niblick on the green. It's filthy art, sir, filthy art. You answered, what is art to me and thee? Will a blacksmith teach a midwife how to bear? That cut the puffing statesman down to size, Ford. You said, otherwise I would have been general of a division. Ah, Ford, was it war, the sport of kings, that your good soldier, the best French novel in the language, taught those Georgian wigged magnificos at Oxford? At Oxford, decimated on the Somme. Ford, five times blackballed for promotion, then mustard gassed, voiceless, some 7 miles behind the lines at Nancy or Belleau Wood, you emerged in your worn uniform, gilt dragons on the revers of the tunic, a Jonah. Oh, divorce, divorce from the whale fat of post-war London, boomed, cut, plucked, and booted. In Provence, New York, marrying, blowing, nearly dying at Boulder, Colorado, when the altitude pressed the world on your heart and your audience almost football size shrank to a dozen while you stood mumbling with fish blue eyes and mouth pushed out fish fashion as you gagged for air. Sandman, your face a childish O. The sun is pernod yellow, and it gilds the airs of all the ages there on Washington and Stuyvesant, your Lilliputian squares, where writing turned your pockets inside out. But master, mammoth mumbler, tell me why the bales of your leftover novels buy less than a bandage for your gouty foot. Wheel horse, oh unforgetting elephant, I hear you huffing at your old brevoort. Timon and Falstaff, while you keep the board for publishers. Fiction, I'm selling short your lies that made the great your equals. Ford, you were a kind man, and you died in want.
This is Sound and Vision on WPSY Art Radio with guest Alexi Wirth. I'm David Humphrey. That was Robert Lowell. You don't hear that accent very often.
No, we were talking about it during the break. He, you know, it's a generation where people, a lot of Americans had these phony English or, you know, mid-Atlantic accents, and he went the other way. He went south. He spent a lot of his time with Southerners, and he had this kind of weird Boston Southern accent that nobody else had. That's kind of a strange, you know, singular artifact for sure. But it's to me, that ending of that poem, "You were a kind man and you died in want," is just a heartbreaking, you know, the kind of little hairs on the back of my neck go up every time I hear it. And okay, so for the next poem, we're going to hear some of a long poem by James Dickey, who was a Southerner, and for a short period, a really great, great poet, until he kind of fell apart after the movie Deliverance made him a celebrity. He was kind of an exemplary person in terms of failure to handle celebrity successfully. There's some very, very poignant, harrowing memoirs about what he was like, including one written by his son, Christopher Dickey. But so this poem is it's a very different setting or subject. I think his introduction tells you all you need to know.
Falling. This is prefaced by a brief quotation from the New York Times. A 29-year-old stewardess fell to her death tonight when she was swept through an emergency door that suddenly sprang open. The body was found 3 hours after the accident. The states, when they black out and lie there rolling, when they turn to something transcontinental, move by, drawing moonlight out of the great one-sided stone hung off the starboard wingtip. Some sleeper next to an engine is groaning for coffee, and there is faintly coming in somewhere the vast beast whistle of space. In the galley with its racks of trays, she rummages for a blanket and moves in her slim tailored uniform to pin it over the cry at the top of the door. As though she blew the door down with a silent blast from her lungs, frozen, she is black out, finding herself with the plane nowhere and her body taking by the throat the undying cry of the void. Falling, living, beginning to be something that no one has ever been and lived through. Screaming without enough air, still neat, lipsticked, stockinged, girdled by regulation. Her hat still on, her arms and legs in no world, and yet spaced also strangely with utter placid rightness on thin air. Taking her time, she holds it in many places, and now, still thousands of feet from her death, she seems to slow. She develops interest. She turns in her maneuverable body to watch it. She is hung high up in the overwhelming middle of things in herself, in low body whistling, wrapped intensely, in all her dark dance weight coming down from a marvelous leap, with the delaying, dumbfounding ease of a dream of being drawn, like endless moonlight to the harvest soil of a central state of one's country, with a great gradual warmth coming over her, floating, finding more and more breath in what she has been using for breath, as the levels become more human, seeing clouds placed honestly below her left and right, riding slowly toward them, she clasps it all to her and can hang her hands and feet in it in peculiar ways. And her eyes open wide by wind, can open her mouth as wide, wider, and suck all the heat from the cornfields, can go down on her back with a feeling of stupendous pillows stacked under her, and can turn as to someone in bed, smile, understood in darkness, can go away, slant, slide off tumbling into the emblem of a bird with its wings half spread, or whirl madly on herself in endless gymnastics in the growing warmth of wheat fields rising toward the harvest moon. There is time to live in superhuman health, seeing mortal, unreachable lights far down, seeing an ultimate highway with one late, priceless car probing it, arriving in a square town, and off a starboard arm the glitter.
I'm feeling all the sharp articulation and skewed perspective of an Alexi Wirth painting.
Well, I wish they had that incredible, weird virtuosity of seeing that Dickie had. I think that all those details, like the one car with the highway with one car probing it, these like beautiful flashes of weird, of hallucinatory vision. You know, that's certainly something I aspire to and love. And I cherish that poem, and it's the whole thing is worth listening to. Although it kind of ends with a thud, so to speak.
He surely delays and nurses the time between.
Yeah, well, I guess her body was found a half an hour later, and it seems like the poem, it takes almost a half an hour to, you know, imagines kind of extends. But I don't, you know, I don't want to be too flip about it. It's actually a really moving and gruesome poem. Should we move on to the next one? The next one is like the Lowell. It's a sort of lifelong favorite poem of mine, and it's right back to the theme of courtship. So this is a kind of it's John Berryman, and it's one of his dream songs, Dream Song 4. And he's in a restaurant, and it's basically just a lust poem, and it's the most, to me, beautiful, comical, perfect. It's a, you know, a feeling, you know, you feel kind of every day, but you know, elucidated here with these he has this character Henry, who's kind of a stand-in for the poet.
Filling her compact and delicious body with chicken paprika, she glanced at me twice. Fainting with interest, I hungered back, and only the fact of her husband and four other people kept me from springing on her or falling at her little feet and crying, "You are the hottest one for days of night. Henry's dazed eyes have enjoyed brilliance." I advanced upon, despairing, my Spumoni. Sabones is stuffed de world with feeding girls. Jet hair, complexion Latin, jeweled eyes downcast. The slob beside her feasts. What wonders is she sitting on over there? The restaurant buzzes. She might as well be on Mars. Where did it all go wrong? There ought to be a law against Henry. Mr. Bones, there is.
I surely have that experience almost daily.
Yeah. There ought to be a law against you, David.
I'm crafting one now.
I love Berryman, and I love, I mean, he was, you know, going back in a way to the poem before, he, you know, had this kind of bizarre exit from the world where he climbed a bridge in, I think it was in Minneapolis, and waited till a sufficient crowd had gathered and then jumped.
What a showboat.
Right. There's kind of, you know, narcissism doesn't get too much more extreme. And the next poet, the last poem here that we'll have time for, is a totally different character, somebody who's to me a kind of a model of the possibility that an artist can be a healthy person and a person of kind of conscientiousness and respectful discipline and not a fuck up.
And not a bore.
Right. All those things and still great. And so this is a very short poem by Richard Wilbur, and it's I imagine him like just walking in the woods or something and stopping and leaning down to take a drink from a brook. And the poem is called Hamlin Brook, and it describes just this super local kind of tiny observable world when you're about to drink or you've just drunk, and suddenly you see everything from the kind of plane of the water surface.
Hamlin Brook. At the alder darkened brink, where the stream slows to a lucid jet, I lean to the water, dinting its top with sweat, and see, before I can drink, a startled inchling trout of spotted near-transparency, trawling a shadow solider than he. He swerves now, darting out to where, in a flicked slew of sparks and glittering silt, he weaves through stream-bed rocks, disturbing foundered leaves, and butts then out of view beneath a sliding glass, crazed by the skimming of a brace of burnished dragonflies across its face, in which deep cloudlets pass, and a white precipice of mirrored birch trees plunges down toward where the azures of the zenith drown. How shall I drink all this? Joy's trick is to supply dry lips with what can cool and slake, leaving them dumbstruck also with an ache nothing can satisfy.
Is that surface of the water a painting metaphor, maybe?
Yeah, totally. And that feeling, how can I drink all this? I mean, I started as a pretty perceptually driven painter. I'm less so now. But I think that's the thing that both makes you love it and gets you out of it. How can I drink all this? There's too much there.
Grand appetites. We're right. Trying to navigate.
Right.
Expectation management. There's so many challenges. Alexi Wirth, it's been really great having you as a guest. Not nearly enough time to cover all this material, but there's so much density there. How do you want to go out?
Well, I thought I'd go out with one song, and this is it's a kind of a poem in itself, and it's a song where the lyrics really are key, and you have to listen to them. It's probably the corniest song anyone will ever have played on your show, but I truly think this is like, I imagine John Conley, the guy who sings this, there's a couple of songwriters, Don Schlitz, and I forget the other guy's name, but I think they heard Bruce Springsteen's The River and thought, we can do this better, and they wrote this song. It's called Old School, and it's so clunky, and yet it does. You think to yourself, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe this. And then they completely redeem and transcend the corniness.
So I'm going to be navigated out of my own embarrassment.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you.
I can remember us cruising through town in your daddy's car with the top pulled down, looking so cool. We came from different sides of the track, but we still held hands out back of the old school. We spent all our time together, laughing and having fun. We swore that we'd love forever, 'cause that was the way things were done at the old school. We both made it to our graduation. You chose a college, I chose a vocation, driving 18-wheel. I became a part of your past. You went and married some guy in your class. He was a big deal. Your picture was in all the papers. You made such a lovely bride. They said you were going places, but me, I just went for a ride down by the old school.
Old school.
I got married to a sweet young girl and kept driving for the line. Your husband made his mark on the world, then he left you behind. Swimming pool. Now here we are at the reunion of the class. You asked my wife if we could have one dance for the old times. We're slow dancing across the old gym floor. You whisper it could be just like before. Call me sometime. You ask if I understand you. Well, yes, I'm afraid I do. You say everybody does it, but I don't care if they do. I'm from the old school. I thought